This is episode 27 of the History of Podcast. I'm Robert.
And I'm Emma. Today, we will be talking about the history of fractional reserve banking.
And this is our fourth attempt trying to record this episode.
Oh my goodness, yes. So the first time we tried to record, we recorded all the way through, but it was like a new method that we were presenting.
You weren't happy with it?
It wasn't the best for both people. Anyway, so we tried again to record, and we had an unexpected visitor. It was nice to have company, but
Interrupted the podcast. And then the third time, we were doing perfectly fine, and we were 20 minutes into the episode, and then the driver for the audio crashed, and all the files got corrupted. And so here we are.
This is our fourth time recording, and let you know, it consists of months' work of research and compiling information.
With the delays, I've also been able to get a little bit ahead on research for future episodes. So that helps in that way. But sorry for the delay, everybody. Let's get into the episode. First, of course, we have the egg carton count. And today's egg carton count is... It's 37, so we are surrounded by egg cartons. And for those of you who are new, that means that we have egg cartons all around our room.
Oh, yes.
Some on the wall, some on really just everywhere.
None on the ceiling yet.
But we have 37 egg cartons all around our room for sound dampening for this tiny podcast studio we have. But let's get right into the episode, and here we go.
Heads up, this episode is going to be a little different than previous episodes, so put on your seatbelt because you're in for a wild intellectual ride. We have a lot to cover, and we don't want to rush, so just hold on, and this might be a little longer than you normally expect. These concepts are a lot to digest. We could do individual episodes on every little thing discussed in this podcast. You really could. But that would just be a podcast on the history of money and...
the history of economics.
We're trying to keep this short and sweet, even though this might be an hour and a half long.
Yeah. Some things we really just have to gloss over because if we need to have some sort of respect for your time. And this episode is already way outside the time constraints of... Mm-hmm. I know when we originally started, we said episodes would be 10 to 20 minutes long, and this one's going to be like... an hour and a half. So
gotta get that quality content.
Quality content. Obviously. But yeah, see, I'd like to know what everybody thinks about us, the history of doing little heavier episodes. And we have some heavier episodes kind of queued up for the next few episodes. But yeah, I'd like to know what you all think about that instead of just not only light episodes like, I don't know, bowling or football.
Socks.
But starting off, we need to define some terms and concepts. Because fractional reserve banking, there are so many new definitions, terms, concepts that it can mm-hmm. be really confusing. And we really just need to take some time to define these things first. And we did a little word on the street interview asking some questions about money, fractional reserve banking, and the Federal Reserve. I asked some friends. And so here's that. Where do you think money comes from?
The government.
But, like, how does it come from the government?
They print it.
And then where does it go after that?
Banks. The banks. Yes.
So where do you think money comes from?
Where? It comes from people.
Like, how does it come from people?
People, it's like, you know, people exchange stuff. So they used to trade stuff, barter. They trade stuff for goods. Now, instead of trading, like, a cow for a hoodie or something, now you give them money.
Where does money come from?
The government.
Does the government print it? Like, what happens?
It's like an ecosystem created so that everyone can, have currency and make trades. It's like an agreed upon currency. So the government does print it. But also prints a lot. Sometimes that causes problems as well.
Have you ever heard of fractional reserve banking?
No, I have not.
Okay, well, just from the name, what do you think it means?
I would say that it is fractions of your money going into reserves at banks.
Have you ever heard of fractional reserve banking?
What do you think?
No.
Yes, you would be correct. No. Never heard of it.
Well, okay. Based on the name, what do you think it means?
Fractional reserve banking. Probably like taking a fraction of your bank and you invest money into it and you reserve it. So that's definitely what it means.
And what is the Federal Reserve?
Sounds like a... I just think of it, immediately think of a reservoir of money, like a giant pool of money, you know what I'm saying?
Close enough, yeah.
All right, let's freaking go.
So, plenty of people, you know, carry on normal lives, not knowing the answers to these questions, but in this episode, we'll explain why you should know what exactly is going on with money and the history of how that came to be. So let's get into defining our terms and concepts.
So, of course, if you want to know the history of fractional reserve banking, which involves money, probably want to go over the definition of money. Most people would say that money is defined as a medium of exchange between trades for goods and services. For example, instead of trading my shoes for your hat, I can trade my shoes for your money. Then I can buy just about anything I want with that money. I would argue money works that way in some economies, or at least it used to.
Yeah, and let's talk about, you know, kind of the way most people would think of banking, and that's full reserve banking. And full reserve banking, the way it works is you deposit money into the bank and they hold on to 100% of that money in a safe in the back. And whenever you want to withdraw, they can give you any amount of money that you have in your name that you need at any time. And they hold 100% of everybody's money in full reserves, full reserve banking. But that's, we'll talk about how fractional reserve banking actually does not work that way. Kind of counterintuitive, kind of a scam that's not really a scam, but it should not be legal.
I don't know if it's a scam, but people just don't really, most
people don't
understand.
To understand how it works, and you need to have an appreciation of how it works. But full reserve banks themselves don't create any more quote-unquote money on top of the quote-unquote reserves for the fiat money. I will define these terms in a moment. Fiat money is, you know, money just created out of nothing. And the fact that we even say that we have reserves is kind of odd because it's just, you know, printed paper backed by nothing that the government can print. Technically not the government. We'll talk about that too. can just, you know, print at will. Or not at will, but on the demands of the economy. And these reserves would be quote-unquote Federal Reserve notes, or pretty much just cash, dollar bills, and things get more complicated with fractional reserve banking.
In fractional reserve banking, money is a representation of debt. In the Federal Reserve Act, it calls bonds and notes, quote, certificates of indebtedness. On a dollar bill, you will find a text that reads, quote, this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private.
And we have a debt-based economy. If nobody were in debt, nobody would have any money, or I guess the banks would have all the money. And this will make more sense in a moment, but because debt is in flux, the money supply is actually in flux. And there's also a great debate as to what defines money. And this is why nobody can tell you how much money exists in total, because the total money supply, I guess how you would calculate that, is how many people are in debt. Because it's a debt-based economy, the fact that we even have money is dependent on more people being in the negative than being in the positive. And so I guess that makes people in the positive kind of an anomaly.
All right, so on to defining fractional reserve banking. Fractional reserve banking is the most common form of banking. Banks only keep a fraction of their depositors' funds in the bank's reserves, and this makes things complicated. Even if you think you know what fractional reserve banking is with the money multiplier, forget everything you could know. I mean, not everything, but most things. It will explain what money multiplier is.
But like, here's the money multiplier way of explaining fractional reserve banking. I think it's kind of an oversimplified explanation, and we'll get into that with spendable IOUs and all that. I know that sounds like a weird term, but it'll make more sense.
You'll be so much smarter once this episode's over.
Like, most economists actually don't fully understand this. They understand money multiplier, but they don't understand what's actually happening. The money multiplier is just oversimplified. So to explain that, to start off, we'll use rubber duckies to simplify things.
Yes, so cute.
So you have, imagine you have 100 rubber duckies that you put in the bank.
Sounds cool.
And the bank only keeps a fraction of them in reserves. And in America, the minimum requirement is 10%. Hmm. And the rest, 90%, is loaned out to other people. The bank would be loaning out 90 of your rubber duckies to Jimmy. And Jimmy puts his 90 rubber duckies in the bank. And now there would be a total credit of 190 rubber duckies in the bank. And say, so there's only 100 in existence, but there's a total credit of 190. Some you think you have and some Jimmy thinks he has, but they're actually the same rubber duckies. And so Jimmy thinks he has 90, and say he has those 90 in the bank, and 9 of them, 10%, are kept in reserves. So 19 total rubber duckies are kept in reserves. And then the bank loans out the other 90% of Jimmy's quote-unquote rubber duckies that are sort of Jimmy's, but I thought were mine. The bank loans out 81 of those to Sammy. And so that's 90% of Jimmy's rubber duckies. And Sammy, say he puts his 81 rubber duckies in the bank, and now there would be a total credit of 271 rubber duckies in the bank, when in reality only 100 rubber duckies exist. And this entire process would keep repeating, in effect multiplying the total credit of money, and the total number approaches 9 times the original amount. And this is not to mention like all the interest that the bank is making on their loans, interest when you pay it back. And this is complicated. Interest rates get complicated, but that's I don't want to say that's beyond our pay grade, but that's definitely beyond this episode, talking about interest rates. And that is, you need to go get a graduate degree in economics if you're doing that.
Yeah, you might have thought that bankers are boring, but if they deal with all this stuff, and this is just a basic rubber duckies example, I mean, whoa.
And then they're making money holding your money. But fractional reserve banking kind of works this way, the money multiplier way, just explained with the rubber duckies. But this the money multiplier explanation assumes that money is not created but reused between depositors. And this is a little misleading, because money is actually created in the form of spendable IOUs. And we'll come back to that. That'll make more sense in a moment. It's a weird term, but just remember, spendable IOUs makes up most money.
Yeah, this is going to be a problem with a bank run or a run on the bank. In a depression or recession, people want to take their money out of the bank and keep it in their possession. I mean, that makes sense. You want to hold on to what you have. If everybody comes to the bank to get their money at once, the bank won't be able to give everybody their money. This is called a run on the bank. Think about those scenes that are in It's a Wonderful Life and Mary Poppins. I love those movies. We're going to play one clip from It's a Wonderful Life.
Here we go.
I have some news for you, folks. I was just talking to old man Potter, and he's guaranteed cash payments to the bank. The bank's going to reopen next week.
But, George, I got my money here.
Did he guarantee this place?
Well, no, Charlie, I didn't even ask him. We don't need Potter over here.
Then I'll take mine now.
No, but you're thinking of this place all wrong, as if I had the money back in a safe. The money's not here. Well, your money's in Joe's house. That's right next to yours. And in the Kennedy house and Mrs. Maitland's house and 100 others. You're lending them the money to build, and then they're going to pay it back to you as best they can. Now, what are you going to do, foreclose on them?
And so this is a dilemma when everybody comes to the bank and the bank can't give everybody their money and liquidity is demanded. So in a bank run, an organization comes in to save the day called the Lender of Last Resort. And we'll talk about Lenders of Last Resort later. I just kind of want to keep it chronological. And it would make much more sense when I discuss it later. I think I'm discussing it, going to mention it with the Panic of 1837, Panic of 1907. And so we'll get to that then. It'll make more sense then.
So just to recap what we learned in this section. So we live in a society that has fractional reserve banking instead of full reserve banking, which means that your money can get loaned out to other people instead of it
sort
just being held
in a way.
Safe.
Well, it's not exactly loan out. We'll talk about how new money is actually created, and most money isn't really tangible money, but credit. But that's, we're getting a little ahead of ourselves. But we live in a debt-based economy where the just pretty much the total money supply is created by the number of people who are in debt, or the net debt of all the people in the United States. And so now we get into really defining, getting to the meat of fractional reserve banking. It goes a little deeper than the money multiplier. Money isn't, like I said earlier, money isn't reused, but new money is actually created. And so, like I said earlier, the US dollar, as well as some other currencies, it's a fiat currency, meaning it's not backed by anything like gold or silver, which it used to be, and we'll talk about the gold standard later. But people think that new money is just printed and put into the economy and never goes away. I used to think when I was a little kid that I was like, I thought all money was cash, and I was like, where does old money go? I was like, where does it go? Is it just printed? And then, like, what happens when it gets out of date? But that's partly true. In fractional reserve banking, money is actually being constantly created and destroyed. And I have a full link for this video or this clip that I'm about to play. And this is Spendable IOUs 1.
Money we spend is a second type, which can best be described as spendable IOUs. The concept of a spendable IOU may sound a little odd, and in order to explain it, we should first consider the behavior of an ordinary IOU, the kind you or I could write. Say that Mick wished to borrow £10 from his friend Jim. He could write, "I owe you £10 on a piece of paper, and hand it to Jim in return for a £10 note. It's important to note that the IOU did not exist previously. Mick did not need to obtain the IOU from somebody else. It was just created on the spot by virtue of writing it on a piece of paper. The IOU that Mick created now has value. It acts as a record or proof of the loan and could be referred to if Mick tried to claim that the loan never took place. But despite its value, Jim would find it almost impossible to purchase anything with it. We will return to this issue of non-spendability in a moment. When Mick repays the loan, Jim should no longer keep hold of the IOU because Mick will no longer owe Jim any money. The IOU has now done its job. It has no further purpose, and Mick will now dispose of it. To summarize, the life cycle of an IOU is as follows. Stage 1, it gets created out of nothing. It did not exist previously and did not need to be obtained from anybody else. Stage 2, it has value as a legal record. And stage 3, when the loan is repaid, the IOU has no further meaning and expires.
Yeah, I apologize about the wonky noise floor on that clip.
Yeah, it's a lot of background noise.
That's kind of how it came. But diving back in, think about this. Not all money is cash. If all money were cash, the creation and destruction of money wouldn't be feasible. A dollar bill, or Federal Reserve note, is just that, reserves. The rest are spendable IOUs. We're going to dive into this next clip, same guy.
Think about what he explained earlier between Jim and Mick, where one has the IOU for $10, and then we'll come back to spendability in a moment. I don't know if it's this clip or the next clip, but this is spendable IOUs too. I know this guy is kind of dry and kind of boring, but really try to pay attention because some good stuff in here.
Good content.
Let's go back a few steps and consider the fact that the IOU was not spendable in a bit more detail. The reason the shopkeeper would not accept the IOU as payment for food was because he didn't know anything about Mick's creditworthiness. In all likelihood, he wouldn't even know who Mick was. If the shopkeeper just by coincidence happened to know Mick and he thought Mick was a reliable fellow, he may have considered taking the IOU in payment. But in general, this will be a rare event. But now consider this. What if a bank had given its official seal of approval to the IOU? Say that everyone knew about and recognized this seal. This would then allay the shopkeeper's worries about who Mick was and whether he was good for the money. A bank seal of approval could turn a non-spendable IOU into a spendable IOU.
And that's where we get into spendable IOUs, where it's a bank seal, imagine a checkbook. And that is, the checkbook is just that, it's a spendable, it's an IOU that's spendable. And then it gets complicated how it links back to the bank. But that's money that's being created by the bank, or it's credit. And so we'll get into this clip, spendable IOUs 3. Please just try to pay attention to this guy. It's tough. It's tough to listen to this guy. I had to watch this video first like 3 or 4 times just to get it. But breaking it down into clips to make it more palatable. So this is spendable IOUs 3.
So now we know in theory what a spendable IOU might look like. But how does this come about in practice in the real world? To see a non-spendable IOU get converted into a spendable one, look no further than an ordinary bank loan. The phrase bank loan is in fact highly misleading. The bank is not lending anything at all. If you wanted to borrow, say, £1,000 from the bank will ask you a series of questions to assess your creditworthiness and then get you to sign some sort of loan agreement. This loan agreement is essentially an IOU you are handing to the bank. What the bank will give you in return is generally not everlasting money. What they give you will be a checkbook or a debit card, which is essentially an IOU from the bank. But because this IOU is so official and recognizable, shopkeepers everywhere will accept it in exchange for goods.
So, if I were to give Robert $333, he would give me a certificate saying, Robert owes Emma $333.
And if Emma were a bank, she would charge interest on what I pay her back, which she actually loaned to me. It was just never actually existed, and I pay her back with interest, and then it gets destroyed. But yeah, we'll get back to this.
That would only be legitimate between Robert and me. The IOU is worthless to anyone else. To make that worth something to other people, I could get a bank seal on my IOU, making it spendable. This is a bank loan.
And so this is spendable IOUs 4. Hold on, this is the last clip. I know this guy is... It's good stuff, but it's... I just can't get past, like, the background noise. I should stop complaining.
I will note, if you want to watch this video, the link for it will be in the show notes.
It is. Yeah, for the entire video. There's a lot that I cut out, but here we go. The suspendable IOUs 4.
Woohoo!
And just like any other IOU, the bank's IOU never existed before this moment. It did not have to be obtained from anywhere else. It was just created on the spot out of nothing. And also, just like any other IOU, it will expire when the loan is repaid. So to summarize, money is created when loans are made, and disappears when loans are repaid. Money is continually being created and destroyed. We can visualize this dynamic by imagining a bathtub with water flowing in from a tap and out through the plug hole. The flow into the bath from the tap corresponds to new loans being made, while the water flowing out through the plug hole corresponds to loans being repaid. So the total amount of money circulating in the economy depends critically on the relative rates of flow into and out of the system.
That visualization of the bathtub was really helpful for me, and if you need to listen to that again, either check out the link in the show notes or just turn it back a minute and listen to that again. But that was very helpful visualization for me, the bathtub with the water going in and the plug hole. But this whole, I don't know how to say this, this whole paradigm makes sense because earlier we mentioned that we have a debt-based economy. And a loan is a means of debt, a means of debt. And to tie this all together, a fractional reserve bank creates money to loan to you. Then you pay the money back with interest, and then the loan is destroyed. And, you know, what happens to the interest? Interest rates get complicated, and it ties into labor, the GDP, and it's a lot to explain, and I really want to keep this episode focused on the history of fractional reserve banking, not all the, I don't know, we don't need it, yeah, not all the details of how exactly it works, really just get an idea, and this is not a graduate economics class, but The Federal Reserve closely controls how much these banks are allowed to lend out and how much they can charge interest, the quote-unquote Federal Reserve. We'll talk about why it's called the quote-unquote Federal Reserve later. And compare this entire system to a credit union, which I would consider a slightly more transparent form of banking, quote-unquote banking. When you open an account in a credit union, you become a shareholder or a partial owner of that union. That's why it's called a union. And on average, credit unions have slightly better interest rates than banks, and they're not for profit, and so they actually aren't federally taxed. However, credit unions can have less regional flexibility, so they're more region-specific, and they have lower budgets regarding websites and the number of physical locations, so brick-and-mortar buildings. I guess that means they aren't making as much money, though, off of holding your money. I guess that's a good thing. It can you know, have some drawbacks, though. But to recap this entire section, we talked about spendable IOUs, which, and that's how fractional reserve banking works, where money is created to, or credit is created to loan to you. You use that credit just as if it were real money, which I guess it is. It's just hard to wrap my mind around. And then you pay that to the bank because you are in debt, and we have a debt-based economy. And then it gets destroyed, but they charge interest on you, and that's kind of how they make their money. And that is the whole business model of the bank, is making money off of holding your money. But let's get into the history of how all this got started.
Absolutely, the history of how all this got started, yeah, after all that terminology. All right, fractional reserve banking history. Banks had existed in Egypt, Greece, and Rome, but nothing like what we have today. In the early 1300s, Venice, banking was already corrupted, some might say. But in 1361, legislation was passed disallowing banks to engage in usury. It also allowed inspectors to regularly check for full reserves. In 1526, account settlements had to be in cold hard coin, not check, meaning money couldn't be created out of thin air. I'm going to apologize to all our Italian listeners. I am about to, hopefully not butcher, but I might butcher some Italian words. So here we go. Pisano and Tiepolo, the largest bank in Venice, underhandedly practiced fractional reserve banking, so it was forced to close. In an attempt to save their economy, a state bank was established, called the Banco della Piazza del Lato.
You just like saying that, don't you?
I do. It's fun. This new government bank was designed so that it wouldn't profit from interest on loans. And this kept out corruption to an extent. Its only profits could be from fees, from notarizations, currency exchanges, coin shortage, and transfers between accounts.
Coin storage.
I'm sorry, misread that.
Yeah, transfers between accounts. And this was about as pure and uncorrupted as banks would ever be. They were just like every other business, except they happened to handle money. And this was good because the public could understand everything that was going on under the hood. There was no smoke and mirrors. And the coins in Venice actually started varying in condition. We got old coins, new coins. And because these were gold coins, that affected their value, the condition of the coins, which led to receipts, led to the creation of receipts which labeled the value of different coins.
The bank had trouble making a profit with their few service fees, so legislation in 1619 established the Banco del Giro, I believe so. This new bank was allowed to create spendable IOUs, except they weren't called that, but same concept. Interestingly, fractional reserve banking popped up in several places all over Europe, seemingly independent from each other. The Bank of Amsterdam was similar to that of Venice. It had honest banking, but eventually turned to fractional reserve banking. And the same was true for the Bank of Hamburg.
I think it's Hamburg.
Hamburg.
Then we get Hamburg. To England, and no one's going to like to hear this, but it's true. Corrupt banking is kind of synonymous with England.
Ouch.
Like, think about that scene in Mary Poppins where he goes to, his name is actually Michael Banks. Like, that's his actual name. When he goes back to the to the bank and he gets discharged. Mm-hmm. Remember that scene? And that's like, that's kind of the vision I, the image, not vision, that's the image I have in my mind of English bankers. That's kind of what I think of. But the Bank of England arose to meet government financial needs in the first place, because England was struggling financially after being at war with France and themselves. They had some civil wars for nearly 50 years. A few of the higher-ups in the government actually met secretly at Mercer's Chapel in London and devised a means by which to create magic money.
Ooh.
The spendable IOUs that you just create, then we pay back, and they make money off it. Like, who cares about conflict of interest when these people can control, like, the output of money? Like, would you not take advantage of, if you had control of the output of money? I hope not, but some people would.
You don't want to, that's kind of an ethical dilemma right there. You don't want to do that. The Bank of England was chartered in 1694, and this was the first central bank. It lent money to the government, but there was a catch. According to an advertisement for the charter, quote, "The bank hath benefit of interest on all the monies which it the bank creates out of nothing," end quote. That interest was 8%, but when the government paid money back to the bank, that bank became reserves. They would then loan out those reserves to the public. That interest was also 8%, so the bankers essentially, if we did the math right, hopefully earned double.
I think it actually, like, compounded somehow, and it came out to, the final number came out to 22%.
Oh.
Yeah.
So more than double, I suppose. Wow.
Yeah.
So, again, remember that scene from Mary Poppins we talked about earlier?
Yeah, where Mr. Banks goes back to the bank with all the corrupt bankers. He's discharged, but he makes the old guy laugh, so it's good for the movie.
Definitely go watch Mary Poppins if you haven't.
So, knowing about the Bank of England should bring a word into your vocabulary. And Emma said it earlier, it's usury.
Usury.
And the Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines it as the lending of money with an interest charged for its use, especially the lending of money at exorbitant interest rates. Also, an unconscionable or exorbitant rate or amount of interest, specifically interest in excess of a legal rate charged to a borrower for the use of money. Keep that in mind. So pretty much people taking advantage of you loaning you money.
Yikes.
Also, another name to know in the midst of all this is the Rothschild family. They had a massive banking dynasty that stretched across Europe, especially England. We can talk more about them in another episode. Just thought we might drop the name.
All right. Talking about money in Europe, but let's talk about money in America. Most of you have probably seen that musical Hamilton. I did. I watched the musical for this episode to get some context. So, yes, all y'all Hamilton fans, I did it. Robert watched a little bit, too. You did,
yeah,
right?
I watched the first 30 minutes. This thing is so long. It's like 2 hours, 40 minutes.
Yeah, I watched it in bites.
You can sit down for that time. And it's like two hour 40 minute song. And it's not that I don't like it. Like, the production is excellent. Just some of the historical accuracy kind of gets on my nerves. Just like, I don't know. I'll leave it at that. I know a lot of people like it, and I'm not hating on Hamilton. So don't come after me.
Now, we're just spitting facts here, so.
Oh, my.
Oh, come on. They might hate me for what facts. I say after this. Okay. Because Hamilton wasn't who lots of people think that he was. His financial system wasn't all that innovative. It just about copied the Bank of England. Alexander Hamilton was a known proponent of national debt. However, he did make clear that America would always have the intention of paying off its national debt. But that doesn't mean it will, though. Alexander Hamilton established America's system of debt / usury-based economics. Keep
and,
that in mind.
Yeah, to recap this whole section, fractional reserve banking really got started in Venice with the... I don't even remember that. That was... got started in Venice, also in Hamburg. So it was kind of in... Hamburg. In different spotty places across Europe where fractional reserve banking got started. The Bank of England was chartered in 1694, and they earned a stupid amount of interest. And also, Alexander Hamilton helped establish our debt-based economy.
Oof.
Thanks, Alexander Hamilton. And now, next, we get into the Panic of 1837. Just kind of keep with the timeline, trying to keep with the timeline. And what it led up to, which was Andrew Jackson's bank war. It indirectly, so the Panic of 1837 indirectly brought about the Third Bank of the United States. And so picture a timeline in your head here. The First National Bank was established on a 20-year charter in 1891. And the charter expired in 1811 and was never renewed.
Wait, you said 1891.
Or 1790, I'm sorry.
About to say, I was like, the math doesn't add
up. The First National Bank was established on a 20-year charter in 1791. And then the charter, it was a 20-year charter, and it expired in 1811. And that was never renewed, so the first bank died. And the Second National Bank was established in 1817. And the second bank had a rough start with the crisis of 1819. And this might have influenced Andrew Jackson's later decision when he would become president, his later decision to veto the renewal of the next national bank. We'll get to that in a moment.
Jump with us to 1832. 1832 was an election year. It was Jackson's re-election. The charter for the National Bank did not expire until 1836. Nicholas Biddle, president of the National Bank, proposed a premature renewal of the National Bank the summer before the election. This proposal was originally incited by Jackson's opposing candidate, Henry Clay.
And Clay knew that Jackson would veto the renewal of the charter and hoped to defame Jackson by leading him to make an unpopular decision. And Jackson did indeed veto the renewal of the National Bank, and veto power is one granted to the president, so Jackson was by no means pushing the limits of his job title. Some people think he was, and I think he might have in a later decision he made, and we'll discuss that. But veto power, I think a lot of people get on to Andrew Jackson for using his veto power. I don't think that was by no means an abuse of power. But in his veto message, Andrew Jackson wrote, quote, "Experience should teach us wisdom. Many of our rich men have not been content with equal protection and equal benefits, but have besought us to make them richer by act of Congress. If we cannot at once, in justice to interests vested under our improvident legislation, make our government what it ought to be, we can at least take a stand against all new grants of monopolies and exclusive privileges, against any prostitution of our government to the advancement of the few at the expense of the many, and in favor of compromise and gradual reform in our own code of laws and system of political economy."
Dang, so he really had a firm stance on this.
Yeah, I mean, one-third of the shareholders of the bank were in England, not America. That is a point of concern, meaning
that is kind of concerning.
Britain partially owned the American bank.
Yeah, that's kind of concerning. Jackson's views were representative of much of the agrarian U.S., as some farmers' alliances had been formed advocating for the abolition of the National Bank. Jackson's decision was popular enough to get him reelected in 1832. In 1833, Jackson pushed the limits of his presidential power. He wanted the funds withdrawn from the Federal Bank to ease the economic impact of its expiration. The incumbent Secretary of the Treasury refused to withdraw the funds, so Jackson replaced him with someone who would. And that seems like he took it a little too far. The money was placed in state and private banks, and Jackson's critics called them his, quote, pet banks. Without a national bank, both state and private banks could issue currency, and this is where fractional reserve banking comes in.
And Jackson might not have fully known the force he was messing with. He was trying too simplistically to get rid of a much more complex problem that's systemically flawed but also completely necessary, or we couldn't have a functioning economy without it.
It's a very complex system.
Yeah. But in 1834, the United States started in effect adhering to the gold standard. And this meant that paper money was, in effect, exchangeable for its equal value in gold. Of course, this made things messy with state banks issuing their own currency. And Jackson further combated fractional reserve banking with the Specie Circular of 1836.
Sounds fancy.
So this meant that real valuable currency had to be used to buy land. No credit or bank loans, no funny money like that.
Just imagine all the people who didn't have money, like what would happen to them? Like,
well, the economy started going downhill, and some blame goes to the decline in speculation, which are investments in certain markets. And people put a lot of blame on Andrew Jackson's policies, though. However, we can't forget that nearly one-third of the shareholders of the National Bank were in England.
Dun, dun.
You can imagine how England would respond to their loss of investments. Wouldn't be very, very happy with America.
Andrew Jackson didn't run for a third term, keeping with the trend or the precedent that Washington set. So his vice president, Martin Van Buren, won the election of 1836.
I will say Andrew Jackson, I think, actually did consider running for a third term.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
He did consider it, but he didn't. He didn't run for a third term.
Okay. Well, maybe intentionally or not intentionally, he stuck with the precedent that Washington set. The Panic of 1837 soon happened after his inauguration, and it would last until the early 1840s. Van Buren's solution to the Depression was the independent treasury, or the sub-treasury system. Van Buren proposed his new economic plan in 1837, but it didn't pass until 1840. The independent treasury was designed to reduce reliance on state banks, but state banks had already made their place in the economy. This reduced reliance was never fully possible. This bank would endure until the rise of the central bank we have today, called or known as the Federal Reserve.
Quote unquote Federal Reserve. And to recap this section, we talked about Andrew Jackson's bank war and the also the establishment of the sub-treasury system. Andrew Jackson's bank war and the Panic of 1837. Remember the renewal of, or the vetoed renewal of the bank. Nicholas Biddle, also named to know, Nicholas Biddle proposing the premature renewal, kind of getting things heated up in an election year, kind of like when we experienced in 2020. But then we got Andrew Jackson indirectly causing the Panic of 1837. Remember, one-third of the shareholders of the bank were in England. And then Martin Van Buren came along with the sub-treasury system, or the independent treasury. And 8 years later, we get the beginning of the gold standard, and the real beginning of the gold standard. And the California Gold Rush started in 1848, and this was when the gold standard really started taking a grip on America. Miners sought wealth and riches by essentially finding more money when they just found money in the ground. However, when the amount of known gold increases, the value goes down, and America's monetary system in 1848 was not elastic like it is now. And under the gold standard, the money stock cannot expand and contract like it does under the Federal Reserve. We have a fiat currency and we can print at will, but I'm getting ahead of myself. In 1861, the first national paper currency was printed in the United States. And the National Banking Act of 1863 set in place a uniform national currency, and that was the dollar. And there was a lot more to this act, but this is not the History of Economics podcast, trying to keep with the history of fractional reserve banking.
Hop with me to after the Civil War. Come with me to the Panic of 1873. There was a pattern of financial panics. A pattern with financial panics is the closing or failure of one big bank or institution. This sparks a bank run, and the Panic of 1873 was no different. And this is only a slight oversimplification. Jay Cook and Company, a big bank associated with the growing railroad industry, closed on September 18th, 1873. This brought about a wave of bank runs. This bank was a primary lender for the Union military during the Civil War.
And after that, it worked with the federal government in funding and executing railroad construction. and the closing of Jay Cooke & Company sparked a domino effect of the closing of about 100 other banks and 18,000 firms total. Economically, this was the worst America had seen up to this point, and the whole panic and depression started before Jay Cooke & Company went down, and it actually started with a stock market crash in Europe. There were several European investors in American railroads, and the effects of this stock market crash eventually creeped their way to American banks. The panic was followed by strikes of railroad workers, which only made matters worse when your railroad workers, like kind of the backbone of the economy, the backbone of America, go on strike. And there were plenty of political sides to this panic, but we won't get into that. The panic and depression would last for 7 years, so panic was the initial incident of everybody panicking. And then the depression, I think everybody knows what a depression is. Just like the Great Depression, an economic downturn that would last for 7 years before America's economy finally recovered.
Do you remember, we discussed the gold standard earlier.
We mentioned it.
Yeah, we did, a little bit. The Gold Standard Act of 1900 made paper money redeemable for gold only. Gold was the only metal exchangeable for paper. It set the price of gold at $20.67 per ounce. A lot of European countries were also doing the same thing at the beginning of the 1870s. Keep that in the back of your mind when we get to the Great Depression. The second most severe, but arguably most acute financial panic of the 20th century was the Panic of 1907. It started on Wall Street on exactly October 16th, 1907, and it was two investors were involved, F. Augustus Hines and Charles W. Morse. They lost their money in big stake investments in United Copper, a copper mining company, and they tried to corner the stock.
And this whole panic was happening in a matter of days. So remember, that started on October 16th. But then after those two investors lost their money, other depositors in banks became unconfident in the banks Hines was associated with. And those depositors actually demanded liquidity or a transfer of their deposits to a more stable bank. And sounds like a bank run. Enter the New York Clearing House. On October 20th, they declared the Hines Associated Banks solvent, which means that they can pay back all debts, or they can pay back all their depositors. So they're all good. They're checked out. They don't need to be bailed out by the lender of last resort. So those were the Hines banks were declared solvent. However, on October 18th, 2 days earlier, hit the news that Charles Morse, remember him from a moment ago, was an associate with the president of Knickerbocker Trust, Charles T. Barney. And Barney was soon fired for his associations.
Ooh.
And this brought a run on Knickerbocker Trust. And this is why the Panic of 1907 is also called the Knickerbocker Crisis. Has nothing to do with trousers, though.
Ooh.
The National Bank of Commerce bailed out Knickerbocker Trust to provide liquidity for withdrawals.
In this case, the National Bank of Commerce acted as a temporary lender of last resort, and the New York Clearing House would be the next level up of lenders of last resort. And what is a lender of last resort? Well, in a bank run or a panic or a depression or anything like that, banks are too big to fail, and that means that banks can't go down. I mean, like, technically they could, but you really don't want them to because the economy rests on their shoulders. If those banks went down, pretty much the entire economy would go down.
To save the day, there is the lender of last resort. And that is an entity that gets money reserves printed to satisfy the liquid needs of an insolvent bank.
This worked slightly differently before the Federal Reserve, but the basic concept is the same. Liquidity is cold, hard cash. When a stock is liquidated, it ceases to become an investment. The investor is just given what it's worth. An insolvent bank is one that cannot pay back the debts of its depositors. A solvent bank is just the opposite, one that can pay back all debts in cash.
In other words, a lender of last resort gets reserves printed to give to depositors who demand it and make them think they weren't quote-unquote scammed, which I'm sticking with the whole scammed thing because it's more provocative. But This printing of reserves increases the money stock and therefore decreases the value of money. So when you have, well, I'm not even going to get to that. When the overall value of money is decreased, everyone has kind of been taxed in a way, because in a way you can't control. So say, Emma, you have $20 and cool. The total money supply is $100, then you own 1/5 of the total money supply, right?
Sure. Yeah, cool.
But if I inflate the money supply and inflate it to $200, so I print 100 more dollars, then you only own 1/10 of the total money supply. So you've kind of been taxed in a way, and your money has been devalued. There's nothing you can really do about it. But this is what happens when heavy inflation comes in. And in the case of the Panic of 1907, there were just clearing houses extending credit to solvent banks. So pretend money. We didn't have the current lender of last resort that we have today, and we'll get to that when we get to the Great Depression.
I think you could do, it might be easier to understand, instead of using money, you could say like blocks. If I have one block and the economy consists of 5 blocks, then the economy somehow gets raised to 10 blocks, and now
then I go from 1/5 of the blocks to 1/10 of the blocks.
Right. So yeah. Maybe that helps other people, maybe it doesn't. All right, rolling that right along. The National Bank of Commerce asked the New York Clearing House and J.P. Morgan for loans. And I guess even they couldn't fully back up their credit. Both were denied. The National Bank of Commerce then announced that it would release itself from acting as Knickerbocker Trust's clearing agent. And after that, Knickerbocker entered a downward spiral. They closed on October 22nd.
If this started on October 16th,
I know.
This is all happening within a matter of days.
That's redonkulous. Interest rates went from 9.5% to a whopping 100%, y'all. 100%. That's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
On October 26th, New York Clearing House decided to issue some loan certificates to bail out their member banks.
Man, this is a problem. This is a debacle. And also on the 26th, New York Clearing House's member banks started putting restrictions on the convertibility of deposited credit into cash. And this brought about a series of other events that allowed the New York economy to recover. And that's kind of counterintuitive. You'd think, oh, those restrictive things, you'd think that would be that'd be bad, but it actually helped the economy recover. And the whole episode was actually finished in under a year. And amazingly, Knickerbocker Trust reopened its doors in March of 1908. And shockwaves from the Panic of 1907 spread throughout the world, but not as badly as the Great Depression.
Yeah, we'll find that out soon. So to recap, if you could help me recap what we just went over, Robert.
Oh, yeah. The Panic of 1907. I keep thinking the 1800s. Panic of 1907. All you really need to know from that is that it all occurred on Wall Street, happened very quickly, within a matter of days, and started with two investors losing their money and a chain of events with bank runs and lenders of last resort. And so now let's get into the creation of the Federal Reserve.
Sorry, I was scrolling around here.
Oh, yeah.
The Panic of 1907 was a causality for the creation of the Federal Reserve. Let's take a look at how that came to be. In 1910, 6 men got together in a secret meeting.
Sounds pretty shady.
Does sound pretty shady. Like, rich shady. Nelson Aldrich was the chairman of the National Monetary Commission, and he would later be on the Fed's first board of governors. Also, remember Henry P. Davidson. He was affiliated with J.P. Morgan and Company. Also, remember Abraham Piot. Is that how you say his name? Andrew.
Yeah. Abraham Andrew,
and he was the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. There was also Frank A. Vanderlip. He was the President of the National City Bank of New York, and he came to represent John Rockefeller. Benjamin Strong was also there, and he was the head of J.P. Morgan's Bankers Trust Company. And he would also be on the Fed's first board of governors. And the other person that was there, Paul M. Warburg, he came to represent the Rothschilds and Warburgs in Europe.
Rothschilds? Remember oh, that? Goodness. Does that ring a bell?
So it sounds like a lot of pretty powerful people.
And together, these six men held a modest estimate of 1/4 of the total world wealth.
Only 1/4 of the entire world wealth? Can Only you just comprehend quarter. That? Just take a moment and just think.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
Oh my goodness.
A lot of... I'm not even going to get into that. I was going to say a lot of debt, but then I'm not even going to try to understand that. But these six men would lay the groundwork for the Federal Reserve, which is pretty much a government-sanctioned cartel. The word federal is somewhat misleading. It seems to refer to a federation. Synonyms include confederacy, league, and coalition. Nelson Aldrich called it a union of banks. And in the words of banker A. Burton Hepburn, the measure recognizes and adopts the principles of a central bank. Indeed, if it works out as the sponsors of the law hope, it will make all incorporated banks together joint owners of a central dominating power.
Sounds sketchy.
To get you guys up, the definition of a cartel is a group of firms that together act as a monopoly, so they eliminate competition. I think you get the point. And actually, perfect competition in the banking industry would be something to see. That might have been something that happened, might have been kind of early Venice, like where they were just like every other
business.
Other business, they just happened to handle money. Don't quote me on that, though. But people, yeah, like, this is how it got started on Jekyll Island. this is how America's current economic central system got started.
These six men that we just mentioned drafted the Federal Reserve Act. I'm just going to put a note in here. We may or may not do a history of private prisons and or mass incarceration, and there are special interest groups who will draft legislation even today. I'm not saying it's necessarily a good or bad thing, but just keep it in mind. The act was passed on December 23rd, 1913. It probably would not have passed without Woodrow Wilson as president. He was a progressive idealist. Some say the act took advantage of his eagerness for reform. Remember, this was all under the gold standard. Now we have a government federation that technically isn't owned by the government and has cornered the market on money itself. If we get rid of it, let's not do it the way Andrew Jackson ended the Second National Bank. Even if it wasn't directly his fault, the circumstances didn't turn out well.
And when World War I hit, so staying with the timeline, when World War I hit, several countries, including the U.S., briefly left the gold standard in order to print money to pay for war expenses. It's amazing how that works. And this was the first blip of eventually doing away with the gold standard. And because the gold standard held economies back, they couldn't expand rapidly. In need of war. And it was reminiscent of mercantilism, which is an economic ideology of exploration in the 16th century. Mercantilism, at the core of mercantilism, imagine that the entire world wealth is a pie, and you want to have the biggest piece of the pie possible. And so the gold standard is kind of that pie. In mercantilism, there's no win-win situations. It's always a win-lose, and it's usually I win, you lose kind of situation. Mm. It's not good, and it's a very one-sided view of economics.
So to recap, the establishment of the Federal Reserve came about through the Federal Reserve Act, and it was heavily influenced by these six men: Aldrich, Davidson, Andrew, Vanderlip, Strong, and Warburg.
What did you call that, Emma? The the legislation that's written, like, not officially in Congress?
Oh, there's like special interest groups, I think, will like push legislation. I'm not super familiar. I need to do more research on that. But I know there was one who promoted special legislation for the 1994 crime bill. It was truth and sentencing. We can get into that in another episode. Alrighty, let me scroll back down here. Sorry.
Well, let's discuss the next big financial event of the timeline.
You've all been waiting for.
Yeah.
In a happy voice.
Why is that in a happy voice?
I don't know. Why not? So, how...
Why not?
Okay, I'm sorry.
Why not?
Irony. Now, the Great Depression was not a good thing. Now, how exactly the Great Depression started could be an entire The History of episode on its own, but that may be a little too niche for us right now, so maybe in the future. The American economy had been growing throughout the 1920s, hence the name the Roaring Twenties. And there are some names to know and remember: Benjamin Strong, Montague Norman, and William Wentworth. There was some collusion to increase inflation and boom bust, and there goes the stock market. Of course, that's not totally what's taught in the history books.
And the price of gold increased, and people started hoarding gold because they didn't trust the banks.
Yikes.
And this was hurting the circulation of the money stock, and that's the total money stock. Remember, that's how much money there is at a given point in time. That's always tricky. We talked about that at the beginning. But the Federal Reserve raised interest rates, and it attempted to deflate the dollar, making it more valuable. And here's why deflation is bad. A lot of people think deflation is a good thing because we always have inflation, and at some time we need to deflate. But here's why it's bad. It decreases circulation. So how do I explain this? If I want to buy something, and I'm waiting... If I want to buy something and it's it costs $30 now, then I'm going, and it's the price is inflating, so it's going to keep going up.
Mm-hmm.
If the value stays the same and the total money stock increases, then the value will then the number on there will increase. So it might go 31 to 32. Then I want to buy it sooner than later, buy it at a lower price instead of a higher price, and so that will increase circulation, so I'm incentivized to spend my money sooner than later. However, if there's deflation and the price goes from $30 to $29 to $28, then I'm going to wait for the price to go down, and then I'll wait and wait and wait, and then I'll never spend my money, and circulation is decreased, and that is bad for the economy. And in the Great Depression, countless businesses failed because of this.
If you know anything about Keynesian economics, if you are a Keynesian economist, you would cringe at the thought.
Economist?
I'm sorry.
Keynesian economist?
Words. If you're one of those people, you would most likely cringe if deflation happened, because you like Keynesian economists promote spending.
Economists?
I'm sorry. okay. So I don't plan on going into that field, so that's good. On March 6th, 1933, FDR closed the banks in order to halt the bank runs on gold at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. The banks were reopened on March 13th, but by that time, dollars were no longer exchangeable for gold.
And on April 20th, FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, required all Americans to give up their gold for dollars. He wanted to stop all the gold hoarding, and the Federal Reserve kept much of their gold reserves in Fort Knox. And the Gold Reserve Act was passed on January 30th, 1934, and it prohibited ownership of gold without a license. In effect, the common Joe could not hoard gold. And it also raised the price of gold from $20.67 to a flat $35. And because the dollar was tied to gold, this devalued the dollar.
There is a very important component of the U.S. financial system that came out of the Great Depression. It's known as the lender of last resort. The lender of last resort we have in the U.S. is, you might have heard of it, the FDIC. You might see that sticker on like the door of a bank that says FDIC.
Or member FDIC.
Member FDIC. FDIC stands for Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. It was established in 1934 out of the Great Depression. The FDIC comes with its problems. There's a moral hazard. The banks it insures are not incentivized to play it safe. So if the banks do something risky, they could always, you know, fall back on the FDIC. And all FDIC member banks get the same protection. This way, banks, as I said, can take more risks with their loans, and the FDIC will still bail them out.
And to recap this section about the Great Depression, so we talked about the collusion to kind of crash the stock market. And we get the people hoarding gold. We get bank runs. We get rapid inflation in the 1920s before the crash. And also the deflation of the dollar, which is a bad thing because it decreases circulation. And we also got the FDIC, which is our current lender of last resort, which came out of the Great Depression in 1934. Next, let's talk about the dollar bill. And on the $1 bill, right above the Illuminati period,
are pyramid.
I said pyramid.
You said period. Continue.
I said pyramid.
Okay.
On the $1 bill, right above the Illuminati pyramid, are the Latin words "annuit quepus." Is it "chepus"?
I don't know. It looks like "coeptus," but again, coeptus? I butcher words.
I probably should have looked this up before, but I did not. "Annuit quepus." I'm not even going to try. Translation: He, meaning God, has approved our undertakings. And on a banner under the pyramid are the words "Novus Ordo Seclorum." And the translation for that is "New Succession" or "New Order of the Ages." And at the base of the pyramid are the Roman numerals for 1776. All that was added in 1935, so take that with what you will.
1 year before the end of World War II, fractional reserve banking saw a new world order. Here's a term to get familiar with, the 1944 Bretton Woods Agreement. You may have heard that term thrown around recently, or that event talked about recently. We could go into way more detail about this in a future episode about international banks, but here's what you need to know. An agreement was made among the Allied nations during World War II in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. The Bretton Woods Agreement established the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, known as IMF. The gold standard that several nations had previously adhered to was dissolved. The US dollar would become the de facto world currency.
And America is the only country allowed to print U.S. dollars, and this makes the entire world economy dependent on the U.S. dollar. And remember, the dollar is a fiat currency, and is only upheld by the legitimacy of the United States government and its military.
Foreign trades from the U.S. were made in dollars. The world price of oil is in dollars. In the 1960s, the Soviet Union collected a significant amount of dollars due to its oil production. These dollars were put in European banks and came to be known as euro dollars. And don't get me started on how complicated that is in a debt-based economy. Just go with it. Look at the sources.
I'm getting a headache already.
Yeah, you're welcome to look into it. The dollar was still tied to gold up until 1976.
That's when we technically officially left the gold standard. But to recap, in 1944, we had the Bretton Woods Agreement, which was in... Bretton Woods,
New Hampshire.
And, yeah, Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. And that was a new world order, or a great reset, if you will. So you might hear great reset being thrown around now. But that was a 1944 great reset before the end of World War II. So now we get into the recession of 2008. Because it is the most recent thing we have discussed, it's hard to find a source that explains it in plain English. And here's how fractional reserve banking ties in. The recession of 2008 saw a drop in the real estate market, as well as small-scale labor markets. A growing number of mortgage lenders were engaging in risky loans and even predatory lending or fraud.
The problem was with incentives. When looking at how loans operate under the hood, banks don't really want you to pay back the loans. In fact, they are benefited when you never really pay back the loan. The banks can also engage in these risky securities because the FDIC is always there to back them up. This is a problem.
And the real estate bubble was also mismanaged by the Federal Reserve. The Federal Open Market Committee, or FOMC, is the Fed's decision-making committee. It did little to nothing to anticipate the pop of the real estate bubble. And some economists believe the FOMC assumed the real estate market would have a limited impact on the entire financial market. I doubt that the FOMC is that simple, but I'm technically not an economist, so my opinions don't carry much weight yet. But that is that on the recession of 2008.
I would like to counter this entire episode with one word: Bitcoin.
And I'd like to mention there's a book called The Bitcoin Standard. I can talk about that later, but it'll make more sense once we talk about how Bitcoin works and all that, which we'll very simplistically talk about how it works. But the Bitcoin Standard pretty much might be the new gold standard because it's decentralized and it's nobody really owns it. Nobody can really get rid of all of it.
The amount of Bitcoin stock is increasing, so I believe around right now, maybe it's gotten a little higher, but around right now, there are nearly 19 million Bitcoins. Time of this recording. The total amount will never reach above 20 million Bitcoins. And there is Bitcoin mining, but we won't get into that much detail. Maybe another episode.
And here's what you need to know. Bitcoin is much more transparent than the dollar. It is open sourced, and nobody controls it from a central perspective. And that's bad for big bankers. And actually, right now, I just looked it up. The price of Bitcoin, one Bitcoin, a single Bitcoin, is $36,151.80 at the time of this recording.
Didn't it get to up to 40,000 at one point?
No, I don't think it ever got up to 40.
I don't follow Bitcoin stock. No, it didn't get up to hear about it.
I don't think it got up to 40, but it was like it was cents at the beginning. And you can hear stories of people who bought it when it was cents, just cents per Bitcoin, and then they threw away their hard drives or digital wallets.
Oh goodness.
And then they were looking for $1 million hard drives later on. Yeah. But this episode isn't about Bitcoin, but we think you get the point. And to recap this entire episode, because this thing was a whopper.
A behemoth, some might say.
The core of fractional reserve banking is creating loans out of thin air to be paid back with interest. The money is then destroyed because it never really existed in the first place.
True fractional reserve banking began in Venice in 1619. The Bank of England was chartered in 1694. They truly defined usury, which is charging interest on loans at reasonable rates.
Unreasonable rates.
Unreasonable rates. I can read,
and
I promise.
Alexander Hamilton wasn't truly who we thought he was. Andrew Jackson also tried to fight the bank and failed, and his policies indirectly led to the Panic of 1837.
The dollar became the official national currency with the National Banking Act of 1863. The Panic of 1873 involved a stock market crash in Europe, railroads, and the closing of Jay Cooke & Company.
And the Gold Standard Act of 1900 made paper money redeemable for gold only. And the Panic of 1907 was an acute panic mainly on Wall Street.
It was the biggest contingency leading up to the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1910. Six of the world's most powerful bankers devised the Federal Reserve Act, which would be passed under Woodrow Wilson in 1913.
And World War I was the first time that nations around the world temporarily left the gold standard. And the Great Depression involved a stock market crash after the Roaring Twenties, as well as citizens holding gold and government mismanagement to follow.
The FDIC was created out of the Great Depression in 1934. It is our lender of last resort, which means it will bail out its member banks if they became insolvent.
The 1944 Bretton Woods Agreement established a new world order of banks, and it made the US dollar the de facto global currency and established some international banks.
We learned how oil is priced in dollars and the rise of euro dollars in the Cold War. The dollar ceased to be tied to gold officially as of 1976.
And the Great Recession of 2008 primarily stemmed from real estate markets. The real estate market grew and grew until it popped in late 2007. And mortgage lenders engaged in risky practices due to poor incentives. And the Fed also failed to take adequate preventative measures for the recession.
To top off all this, we have Bitcoin, which is the nightmare of all powerful fractional reserve bankers.
And so the takeaway is don't become dependent on banks, especially big banks. And there's a reason why everybody in Silicon Valley wants to be your bank, and now you know why. We have Apple Pay, Garmin Pay, Amazon Pay. I remember for a little while, they might still have it. Facebook had Libra.
That's a lot. So essentially, please try to stay out of debt.
And history repeats itself in cycles of about 80 years. You might notice that. And that makes sense because that's about the time when the oldest generation is no longer around to remind everyone else what mistakes not to make. So we remake those mistakes about every 80 years. So please don't take this episode for granted. And I'd like to finish with a quote from Kanye West. And as he's saying in a song, "If I put myself in harm's way to get my own master, he'll put himself in harm's way to stay the master."
Well, if you made it this far, I believe you've listened to our entire episode. How long are we at now?
Right now, we are at an hour 14, an hour 15.
Okay, so that's kind of mid of what we thought it would be, hour and a half. Well, thank you so much for sticking with us. This was pretty similar to a normal format, a little different though. I hope you liked it. And if you want to listen to us on YouTube, you can totally look us up. It's just another platform to look up the history of. Please follow us on Instagram. I think we have some cool content. We might have some cooler content coming up soon.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, look up the History of podcast. Link is also in the show notes for that. And there's lots of stuff going on in the cancel culture. So for some reason, we get brought up in cancel culture. Feel free to find us on Podcast Index. It's a free speech platform, and hopefully they won't take us off.
And it's way more than just a free speech platform. There's actually a podcast between two guys, Adam Curry and Dave Jones. Adam Curry is actually the inventor of podcasting, known as the Podfather. And it's called Podcasting 2.0. And it's really, interestingly, you won't be able to find it on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And it's about how they're really changing the face of podcasting. It's Podcasting 2.0. And mm-hmm. I'll just leave it at that. And starting soon, I don't know if it's next episode, but soon, we might do donations, value for value. So whatever you got out of this episode, whatever this was worth to you, say maybe you went to a movie, $10 a movie ticket, you paid for two friends, $30, bought some snacks, say it ends up being $40-$50. Was that what this episode was worth to you? Was that what everything we've brought to you so far, is that what this was worth to you? Because we've put a lot of work into this podcast.
A lot of work.
And we hope it was worth something to you. So we will get that set up soon. It isn't set up right now, but I thought this episode would be pretty timely to announce it. And if you have any questions or comments about the information provided in this episode, please contact us at thehistoryof365@gmail.com.
Have a blessed day. And you've got to promise me something. Never stop learning.